W1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. The father of a one-year-old who died from a fentanyl overdose at a Bronx daycare center, saying he trusted the owners and never could imagine this would happen.
The real business was behind this screen. Mm-hmm. Taking the life of the kids on risk just for make money on this way. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that.
Otoniel Feliz says he knows he'll get justice, but it won't bring his son back. Two of three people charged in the case have entered not guilty pleas. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says President Biden didn't have a choice but to move forward with new construction of a border wall with Mexico.
His stance on the border wall has not changed. He does not believe it is effective. He's been very clear about that.
San Francisco and the family of Dianne Feinstein paid their respects to the late senator at a memorial service featuring remarks from President Biden, Vice President Harris, former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and Mayor London Breed. This is ABC News. The Nobel Prize in Literature has been awarded to Norwegian author Jon Fosse. White House staffers and Secret Service have had a rough time with Biden's dog commander.
President Biden and the First Lady's German Shepherd commander is no longer at the White House after recent biting incidents. A spokeswoman for the First Lady said the Bidens are evaluating next steps and care deeply about the safety of those who work at the White House and protect them every day. The Daily Mail reported that commander bit longtime White House groundskeeper Dale Haney on September 13th, publishing what they said were exclusive photos of the incident taken by a tourist. That would be commander 12th known biting incident since he joined the Biden family in December 2021. The White House didn't respond when asked if Haney was injured. Karen Travers, ABC News.
AT&T and Gallaudet University have developed a football helmet to help players who are deaf or hard of hearing and communicate using American Sign Language. The school is a private, federally chartered university in Washington, D.C. for the deaf and hard of hearing. Andy Field, ABC News.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
For the Talk of Green Bay News, I'm Pete Schwabe. Here's what you need to know.
The search on the Fox River for a 21-year-old Green Bay man has been suspended by the Coast Guard. The search for Victor Torres Guadalupe started about 2 a.m. on Wednesday, but authorities decided they didn't have enough evidence showing he had entered the water. They are asking for the public's help in finding him. He is 5'10", about 155 pounds, has black hair and brown eyes. Anyone with helpful information should call the Green Bay Police Department. The man who created the G logo on Packer helmets has died. John Gordon designed the iconic G while he was an art student at St. Norbert College in the early 60s. He was asked to design a logo that resembled a football by a St. Norbert equipment manager. He passed away Saturday at the age of 83 after struggling with Alzheimer's. Tonight's Powerball jackpot is $1.2 billion. That's the third largest ever, and it'll go up slightly after I buy my ticket later. Good luck. Pete Schwabe, WGBW 97.9 News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Holler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear, and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Sometimes
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
UPS Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
News.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So with all the craziness going on, and look, you know, we've got a house that's on fire. It's hard to focus on anything else, but the reality is we still have to focus on how do we move our economy forward and make it to where it works for average, everyday working people. And look, as I've said, you know, we've got a Republican Party hell-bent on chaos. A shutdown is not too long down the road, no functional house to head that off. We got lots of problems. And a big part of that is, well, we've got an economy that seems rigged against average, everyday working people. That's why I've asked our good friend Kat Hadley to come talk with us. She's the director of the Great Economy Project. AmericanAgenda.com is their website. They're out there doing the education work of getting people to understand there is a possible better way. There are other alternatives. This isn't the only alternative. We can do better. Kat, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here again.
So where are we? What are we doing? What's the good news so far? I know you're out in Wisconsin. You're out in North Carolina. You're coming to Pennsylvania. What's going on?
So we have a lot going on. We just wrapped our education portion in Wisconsin, and out of our cohort, over 98% of people decided to stay and work on advocacy. And so how our program works is that we go in and we give people our view of the economy that is pretty much that it's rigged against the working class, that the wealthy aren't paying their fair share in taxes, and that there should be a livable minimum wage for everybody. So we talk about those issues. We bring in experts. And then we basically say, do you want to stay and help us work on these issues? So it's really great to see that in North Carolina and now in Wisconsin, we get these massive response rates to stay on and do something. So in Wisconsin, you're going to see some people start really moving and shaking on this issue, especially the minimum wage piece on the state level in Wisconsin. We're going to be back for training soon. And in North Carolina, that's looking like people, you know, testifying in front of the House and the North Carolina House about different things. And they're at different fairs just talking to their fellow citizens about these issues and trying to make a difference. And then on November 1st, we're going to be launching in Pennsylvania. We'll be in Mount Pleasant. So anyone's welcome to come out. It's totally free. You get free dinner. You get to learn about stuff. We have door prizes. It's real fun. So come out if you can.
No, that would be great. You know, what you're doing is what I've been saying, you know, for years has to be done. Activating, educating, engaging voters, getting people, you know, to take ownership. To, you know, democracy, they say, is participatory. This is how you participate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for a lot of these people, because we go to smaller towns, you know, we specifically target around 5,000 person towns, because the idea is if one person knows, 20 other people know. If you're a small town person, you might know that very well. But what I love about this job is really showing people, like, you have a voice and that voice matters. And sure, this is going to be hard work and we might not get there overnight, but politics is one of those things, like once you turn on to politics, it's really, you know, like that's it. Like that's how I fell into political work was, you know, seeing a problem and realizing, oh, somebody should say something about this. And
understanding that you can make change. I mean, you know, we've been sold on this idea that you can't fight City Hall, that, you know, the big moneyed interest, you know, they control everything. And I say, look, you know, sure, they've got all the money, but we've out-procreated them. There are more of us. We can vote. We can, while we still can, because I fear we're heading towards a period where maybe we might not be all able to vote. But while we still can, we still have the ability to outvote the moneyed interest.
Yeah. Well, and I always tell people, you know, a lot of my friends, I'm 35. And so there's a lot of younger folks that I hang out with. And I always tell them when they're like, well, this is hopeless and I'm walking away, I try to challenge that as like, who do you think benefits when we think this way? Who's benefiting from us just saying, okay, well, it's too hard, so we're walking away? And then also, as somebody that's done a lot of activist work, I did food stamp expansion in Michigan when it was Republican controlled and won on everything we were fighting for there. I've done childcare expansion on campuses, all types of stuff. And the thing is, you can win and you can fight City Hall, and I have. It's hard work, but you can do it. I just always think about who's benefiting from when we feel like nothing can happen, because it's rarely the people doing the good work.
And you guys, you focus on one of my most important issue, and it's not the sexy issue that, you know, everyone gets all riled up about, but our tax code is so badly rigged. The game is so badly rigged that the wealthy and the powerful get all the benefits, and, you know, I think George Carlin said it the best, you know, the rich get all the money, do none of the work, the middle class does all of the work, pays all the taxes, and the poor are there to scare the hell out of the middle class, so they keep showing up to the jobs. That pretty much sums up our economy.
Yeah. And if we even have a middle class at this point, you know, I mean, we have one, but it's a sliver of, you know, when I was a kid, you know, there was a solid middle class. You know, I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I think we're like pre-pandemic, we were the eighth most economically segregated city in the United States. And there's no way it hasn't gotten a lot worse. And, you know, the only people I know that still live around here, because I worked in food service for a long time, I was like a high school dropout, went to school a lot later. But like the only people I know are people that maybe got a house, something like that, you know? And I think it's sad because it impacts our cities and our worlds and our communities. But you know, the other thing too, there is that we, you know, this economy is not working for anyone. And once you really break into that tax code, it's sickening how rigged it is. And just America deserves a lot better. And so that's really what we're trying to tell people is you know, I think in America, there's a big onus on personal responsibility. So you may feel like the system is rigged, but you feel like at some point I made this mistake and now I'm in this financial situation. But the reality is, you know, I meet people say like, well, maybe I want to be a millionaire someday. And I just, you know, I tell them, I'm like, the way our economy is headed, I'm not going to lie to you. That probably will never happen for you. You know, it won't happen for me either, but you know, we have to fix this system because it ties into all of our other stuff. If we have the wealthy paying their fair share, what will the world look like? You know, and one thing we try to challenge people on when we talk about a living wage, because people get, you know, have ideas, and there's been a lot of propaganda around minimum wage. One thing I ask people is like, what if, you know, Richland Center had a $20 minimum wage? What would that look like for your community? And people start thinking about not just who's impacted, but the whole city. Like, what does that look like? Because that means more small business. That means better everything. All of our systems are being paid into. I mean, everyone benefits when we do these things, when we raise the wage.
No, this is why I think the fight with the big three and the UAW is so important. You're talking about sharing the profits of labor in a more equitable fashion so that it does actually trickle down like it used to when my grandparents were alive. Not since we've been trickling down, but before pre-trickle down, before they told us things would trickle down, it actually did. Once they said, hey, it'll trickle down, it kind of stopped. But you're right. We paid into Social Security. We paid into unemployment. We paid into Medicare. The more people earned, the more taxes they paid to the local government so that you got more services. The machinery was working better when people had higher wages. And we're able to pay higher taxes. And that is not a bad thing.
No. No, and I think, you know, it's like, imagine what our communities can be when people can afford to do things. And I will say, you know, I'm a library board, proud elected Ann Arbor Library Board trustee in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And our library was able to unionize, and they were able to talk about, you know, like how having a living wage is so important there, because so many people can't even afford to live in the city and have to travel in, you know, and how does that impact things like climate change? I mean, these things are all connected. So I think it's, you know, well, there are tons of priorities we can look into. A living wage is massive. And then it's just somebody that worked on minimum wage. And this was back 10 years ago. But I remember working the hardest hours of my life. Like 40, 60 hours on my feet, just coming home exhausted and not being able to pay rent. And that's there's no dignity in that. And I truly do believe, like, America's worth fighting for, and America where people can pay their bills is the America that I believe in. So that's why I do this work.
No, that's spot on. You know, I say every time a new president comes into office, it's my hope that they will be the one who returns reward to work. And Joe Biden has been that guy for me so far. All the things that he has done with the Department of Labor, the National Labor Relations Board, the talk and the support for workers, that is incredibly important. If only we had a House of Representatives capable of passing some kind of legislation that could make organizing easier and could help an actual push to rebuild our middle class. Boy, would that be something. Instead, we've got a giant chaos show of children running amok. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Kat Hadley. Kat is the director of the Great Economy Project. AmericanAgenda.com is the website that you can check out the work that they do. Let's go back to this for a minute, because, you know, I love the work that you guys are doing. And in fact, in North Carolina, you went into a small town, Whiteville, right?
Yep, Whiteville, North Carolina.
And you went in there, you know, red hat, blue hat, didn't matter. Right, left, didn't matter. Democrat, Republican, didn't matter. It's about the issue. And as I say, the frame is not red hat, blue hat, it's hard hat. We've got to rebuild this country. And that's what I love about what you guys are doing, that it's not about, you know, which team you're on. It's about how do we make lives better. And I think if we did more of that, maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm just, you know, being overly optimistic, you know, maybe we would actually accomplish some things.
Yeah. I mean, I think that when we focus on the issue, you know, and this is the thing, I think that as somebody that I've done a ton of across the aisle work, and people always ask me, you know, especially when they're on one extreme side or the other, like, how do you get them to talk to you? And I'm like, I talk to them like they're human beings. And I talk about my issue passionately. And I think that, you know, for the most part with this thing, people feel this like to their core. They've felt the decline of their financial power. They felt that shrink. And so when you come in and you kind of disarm them by saying, listen, I'm not going to tell you who to vote for. I don't want to talk to you about any of this other stuff. I want to talk to you about money, and I want to talk to you about solutions we think we have, and we want to see if you're interested in helping us. And I think when you do that, you know, people are willing to listen, at least hear you out. You know, they don't always 100% agree, but often they do. And, you know, it also creates a system where, you know, we have in North Carolina, the two women that run the program there. I mean, they're like our biggest helpers down there. One's a Republican and one's, a Democrat. And they work together all the time. And we're in a group chat, you know, and it goes beyond, you know, I just think we've become so... we've gotten so far away from each other. And I think there's valid reasons for that. And I'm not going to discount some of those reasons. I understand some of them. But I think when we can learn ways to talk to each other, that's just really important and really special. And so I'm really grateful to be a part of that. And you see it again in Wisconsin, and hopefully we're seeing it again in PA. And so it does bring me some hope that people are willing. And you know, you see people willing to help others. We have people in the program that are making good money, but they realize, you know, my neighbor isn't, and I want them to be okay, or my community could be better because of this. And so they get involved. And so that's excellent to see.
No, isn't that the story of America, supposedly? Is that what we're led to believe is supposed to happen?
Yeah. I mean, and I think it still can, you know, but it's scary, you know. And I think, you know, in North Carolina, we had Brittany go and test. She was one of our original cohort members, and she went to testify because, you know, they passed this new law around. She went to protest against it and to make a comment against it. But with the redistricting maps, that you can't FOIA anything they're talking about. And so she went and just talked about how this will impact advocacy, because, you know, Where's the control lever for any accountability with any political power when politicians are writing the maps and, you know, they're the ones in charge of these things? And then to counteract that FOIA law, they're also saying we're going to, you know, start this GovOps program where we can investigate whoever we want. I mean, on the state level, there's some really scary things happening on a national level. So I think having these people come together and say, hey, wait a minute, this is something I don't really normally pay attention to, but I know this will impact us and I want to fight back against it. Like, that's, I think, just really important to have going on in general from both sides of the aisle. We got to hold these politicians accountable on both sides.
Yeah. No, to unpack what you just said, because I want to make sure that the gravity of what you just said is gotten, that you cannot file a Freedom of Information Act on what they're doing. So there's no way to have any oversight by citizens over what our elected officials are doing in North Carolina. And they're setting up basically a secret police force to be able to go after any advocacy group. So basically your citizen lobbying could be, well, criminalized.
Yeah. And that's horrifying, right? Like, I mean, and just like, this is, it's, you know, and there's no, we need people to be running for office to be aware of these things, you know? And I think that the scare tactics, you know, and they already exist. Like, when you go to make public comment, everything's intimidating and it's all on purpose, right? Yeah. And so, you know, what we're trying to really tell people is, you know, that this is your government too. You know, whenever I get upset about stuff, which is often, but you know, it's also like, this is also our country and I'm not going to let them get away with this. They can try, they can pass legislation, but I'm still going to be here and I'm always going to fight back against this because I do love America. And I think this is absolutely corrupt and wrong. And I think that it's worth fighting for,
and that
goes back to that limit when we say, well, there's nothing that can be done now. There absolutely is stuff that can be done. Is it going to be hard? Yeah, but it's still worth doing. You know, North Carolina is worth fighting for. Pennsylvania is worth fighting for. Michigan is worth fighting for. Every state is worth it. And Amen. People are worth it.
Amen. AmericanAgenda.com, the website. We'll get links out on social media. Kat Hadley, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Love to have you come back, especially when you come to Pennsylvania, and share with us what's going on there. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Kat is the director of the Great Economy Project. Again, AmericanAgenda.com, the website. Quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, rich guy, Jim Justice, governor of West Virginia, running for Senate, oddly enough. Evidently, the federal marshals have been instructed to seize a 2009 Bell helicopter that belongs to a company owned by Jim Justice and his family because, I guess, unpaid debts. And this is one of those this is one of those weird kind of things where you go, another one of the rich guys showing us how they evade paying taxes. You know, He doesn't own the helicopter. His company does. But he gets to use it whenever he wants. And this is one of those things that as working people, we don't really quite grasp. So when the, you know, the rich dad, poor dad guy says, you know, rich people don't pay taxes, he's not lying. He's being very honest. You know, when Donald Trump said, you know, I'm smart, I don't pay taxes, you know, he's being honest. They're going to screw the system every chance they can because they lobby for it. They spend a lot of money to rig the game so that they benefit. And as I said the other day, you know, my grandfather always said, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it, because they get return on investment. They know that the couple of thousand dollars that they hand out in campaign donations is going to come back to them in multiples because the tax code has been rigged so badly. And this has always been one of my main issues, because I think if you have a more fair economic distribution, if your work and your labor is compensated fairly and you make a decent living, a lot of our problems begin to go away. If we don't have gazillionaires who have such outweighed power that, well, they can take on we the people, I think you have a different society. But what we've done is we've Reagan forward. We've rigged the game to allow the very wealthy and powerful to get away with whatever they want. Which is why this thing with Trump is so important. Why the fact that, you know, the Justice Department and our justice system is going after a former president because of all of the crimes. And I remember back in 2015, I talked about this extensively because we had a bunch of people on over that year who had been screwed over by Trump and his businesses. We had contractors who came and said, you know, we did all this work, and, you know, they basically stiffed us and then sued us and, you know, offered us pennies on the dollar, and we had to take it because they would just tie us up in litigation. That was his MO. And it was amazing to me that anybody would actually work for the guy. But it was one of those things where you didn't know about it until he came out, because there was always gag orders and there was always threats of being sued if you told anyone, because that's what rich people do. And that's what, you know, someone like Trump did. And I remember going, you know, I don't know why this guy's throwing his name into the ring. At some point, all of this stuff has to come out. Now, again, you know, I go back to 2015 with my 2015 brain, thinking that the American people were the people that I thought they were, you know, in 2012 or 2008 or 2004, that the kind of scandal, the kind of corruption, the kind of graft that we saw out of him would turn people off. But oddly enough, in 2016, it actually turned people on. It actually got people to go, yeah, he's a smart businessman. He knows how to game the system. He's going to do it for us. And I don't know how you made that turn. You know, I get, okay, he's a smart business guy who knows how to screw people over and screw the system and benefit himself. I get that. Completely understand that. I don't know how you make this turn that it's somehow going to benefit the rest of us. I'm still mind blown at that magic trick, at that act of mental gymnastics that you would think that this guy, who has never shown any inclination of helping anybody but himself, magically, overnight, coming down an escalator, now makes him benevolent. It's really quite curious to me. And maybe if we still have the ability to think freely in 50 years, maybe if we're not a fascistic dictatorship in 50 years, maybe they'll write about this era. And maybe they'll have a better answer. Because I get the idea that, like my family, they believed that the jobs were going to come back. They believed that, you know, they were going to recreate those union jobs and that, even though there was no basis for that whatsoever. Other than, you know, the analogy I always use is, you know, a drowning man, when you throw him an anchor, will reach for it, because it's, who knows, potentially could help. So I find it very interesting that this is where we are. Also very interesting, and this is where everything that Trump has ever touched, everybody who's touched it has been burned. And just look at the wake of misery that he's left. The fact that Mike Lindell, who I guess at one point someone said was a billionaire, has lost it all. It's all gone. Gone. That to me, just remarkable. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your podcast, you will find ours. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1945. That was a day known in Hollywood as Black Friday. After World War II, the movie industry began to rake in profits. But they did not pass those profits along to their employees. 10,000 members of the Conference of Studio Unions were on strike. They were part of the Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners. They were also in a jurisdictional battle with the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, or IATSE, over who should represent stage decorators. The strike wore on for half a year. The studios had more than 100 films backlogged and were able to wait out the strikers. But as the strike continued and the studios remained silent, pressure mounted. Despite the tensions between the two unions, thousands of IATSE members refused to cross the picket lines. On Black Friday, the strikers decided to concentrate their efforts at the Warner Brothers Studios gate. 300 picketers gathered to hold the line. Scabs, hired by Warner Brothers, tried to drive through the workers' picket lines to the studio. Variety accounted what happened next, writing, quote, "Strikers deployed from their barricades, halted non-strikers, and rolled three automobiles on their sides. By noon, reinforcements arrived from both sides. Firemen were called in to turn their hoses on the striking workers. Warner Brothers security deployed tear gas. Common for the time, accusations were hurled that the Conference of Studio Union Strikers were communists. As a result of the strike, the Conference of Studio Union's employees were assigned to other jobs in the studios. When they refused, they were locked out. The union never recovered. The violence at the Warner Brothers Studios gate also helped to fuel the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act through Congress, which eroded union protections. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
What amazes me about outbreaks of bribery among high government officials is not just the level of greed involved, but that the take is often so cheesy. For example, there seems to be no end to the ongoing saga of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's peddling his position and prestige to right-wing corporate titans for what? Free rides on their jets, golf outings, and assorted baubles. He's supposed to be an impartial justice, but he consistently supports rich interests who are picking up his tabs. We taxpayers provide $274,000 a year in salary to Thomas. Why wouldn't he buy his own baubles and protect a smidgen of his judicial integrity? Now comes New Jersey's Senator Robert Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who has been oddly insistent on giving U.S. weaponry and financial aid to Egypt's repressive military dictatorship. Why? Because Menendez has sunk butt deep into influence peddling, using his position to advance Egyptian interests. In exchange, Egyptian agents have blessed him with huge wads of cash, gold bullion, a Mercedes-Benz convertible, and a no-show job for his wife. Oh, they also delivered an air purifier for his home. Seriously? An air purifier? That's a mighty cheap sellout. Yet, what a priceless symbol of the whole stinky deal. Meanwhile, Menendez says that the donations are unrelated to his honest concerns about our Mideast foreign policy. He proudly asserts that his senatorial assistance is just the, quote, normal work of a congressional office. This is Jim Hightower saying, sadly, he's right. Most Senate offices today routinely do official favors for moneyed interests in exchange for millions of dollars in bribes. But that's such an ugly word, so they call the big money payments campaign contributions. Then they get indignant when we call the system corrupt, but that's what it is. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I was reading a story over at the Ohio Capital Journal, and they're talking about how the Ohio governor and Republicans in Ohio are about ready to major overhaul of the Ohio education system, going after the Department of Education there, going after the State Board of Education, basically hatchet job, major overhaul, they said. Now, a judge said, hold the phone. There's a restraining order because they want more, slow this down a little bit. Governor's saying, no, we're going. And his response was, there's certainly a potential for chaos. No, I think that's what they want is chaos, because I believe, and I still believe this to my core, the goal is always destroy public education. That's what happens when these people get their fingers on the education system. It's all about destruction. And I look at, states like Iowa, who are doing their foolhardy best to destroy what was once, the gold standard in American public education. And here to share some thoughts on just how bad things are in the state of Iowa, I've asked our good friend J.D. Scholten to come talk with us. He's an Iowa state representative. J.D., thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me back on. And it's absolutely despicable to see where we're at in public education here in Iowa compared to where we were. When I graduated high school, we were first in the nation in education, and now we're at best middle of the pack. And now we passed school vouchers, and where I live in Sioux City, Iowa, our school board said that it's an automatic 8% cut to public education because of that. And you look at the majority of rural schools, they don't have an option to send their kids somewhere else to a private school. And so it's so frustrating to see what the Republicans and what this governor is doing to such a strong foundation and such a pride that we had when it came to public education.
And the thing for me, JD, is they're not even trying to hide it anymore. I mean, before right. It used to be, we want to give people an opportunity. We want to give poor people a chance. And now they're just right out in front. They are full hearty. We want to destroy public education.
Right. And what we're seeing here, to me, public education is the great equalizer. It doesn't matter your background, doesn't matter the zip code that you grew up in. You have a chance to better your life because of public education. And so that's why I'm so passionate and why we shouldn't be so passionate about funding public education. But it's absolutely ridiculous. And what we're seeing here in the state of Iowa is that the majority of kids who were the rich kids who were already going to private school, they're the ones who are going to get a lot of the money. And it's not going to the poor kids or anything like that. It's so frustrating that this is just another example of
the windfall.
The wealthy are going to continue to have breaks while the working class gets left behind.
Yeah, but that's not new. That's always been the gig, because the vouchers, and I still remember, when before Mike Fulmer got into trouble here in Pennsylvania, he was advocating a voucher bill. And I remember asking him, going, look, the Abington Friends School in Philadelphia is about, $40,000 a year for kindergarten. If I get one of these golden tickets, if I get one of your vouchers, I get one of these golden tickets, can I send my kid to Abington Friends School and will it cover? Oh, yeah, it covers all the costs and transportation. The answer is no, it doesn't. It covers what my school district would have paid for my kid to go to that school, which is about $12,000 or $13,000. I don't have the other $27,000 to make up. So it was just a windfall for people who were already sending their kids there.
And that's what we're seeing in Iowa, is the majority of private schools up their cost this year, because they were only charging $3,000, and now they can get up to $7,000. So they doubled their prices.
Yep.
So then in the state of Iowa, we're not allowed to audit the system. It was the most fiscally irresponsible bill Iowa has ever seen, because we don't know if it's going to be positive or negative. There's no reporting on it, no auditing. And then you look at down in Florida, where you see the parents are buying PS5s and just
big screen TVs. Have nothing
to, right. It's a joke. And when that money could be spent to help the communities and investing in public education, where every kid has the chance to succeed.
I said the other day on the show that, the push had always been to destroy public education. And I know people years ago, and I've been talking about this for at least a decade now, that the goal, especially for the homeschool community, would be to, hey, you know, we pump out a bunch of kids, especially the quiverful folks. We punch out a bunch of kids, and the school pays us to homeschool them, because, you know, the money that they get, every kid gets, comes in a backpack. So if you go to a charter school, you go to a, you know, a private school, you go to homeschool, it gets paid to that entity. I've now taken it to the next step of going, because we're destroying child labor laws, that now we're going to take that money, not for homeschooling, but because work will eventually be considered education, we're going to pay employers to abuse children as cheap labor, and that will be the wet dream wish list item of the year for corporate America.
I mean, child labor is absolutely disgusting, and to see what happened in this spring, both the child labor law that was here in Iowa, but even before that, the federal report from the Department of Labor that said, I think it was over 12 meatpacking plants in 8 different states. There's over 100 kids working night shifts and overnight shifts as cleaners, and absolutely just disgusting. You know, these kids should be in school. They shouldn't be working overnight shifts. And, but like collectively, I think the whole, the report ended up showing that collectively they only got fined about $1 million. So to these companies that are making billions of dollars, these monopolies, these huge multinational corporations that have a stranglehold of our agricultural system, and just to slap them with $1 million fine, they'll pay that in a heartbeat and do it all over again the next month.
Yeah, see, I can solve our child labor problems in one single page piece of legislation, and I wouldn't fine anybody a dime. You would never pay a fine in my world. But if a child gets, you have any child labor violations in your factory, in your meatpacking plant, the CEO goes to jail. Simple.
Exactly.
I mean, that's absolutely how it should be. You're the top guy of the company. You should know what's going on. If you're allowing kids to be put in dangerous situations, you're breaking the law, you're responsible. No fines, no slaps on the wrist, no, oh, hey, post a notice. No, you go to jail.
It makes sense to me. It's so... The corporation or the corporate crimes that just, it seems, never go accounted for. We need to start changing that. And, you know, I am grateful for the FTC and the DOJ, and they're starting to crack down on some of this stuff. And it's going to be interesting to see some of these lawsuits, the Amazon lawsuit and the Google lawsuit. It's antitrust, but it also has a form of accountability at the executive level as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've been waiting for a very long time, and, you know, I've been saying, you know, who's going to be this generation's Teddy Roosevelt? You know, who's going to be the trust buster? Who's finally going to start breaking up some of these monopolies, because they're getting too big? I mean, I was talking to somebody about inflation today, and they were going, you know, it's all Joe Biden's fault. I'm going, no, it's not Joe Biden's fault. It's those 192 people who sit on the business roundtable who have been raking in obscene, massive profits, who have been gouging our eyes out for all these years. It's their fault. They're the ones who have caused this massive inflation. In fact, they've actually put a number to it. 52% of the inflation is because of corporate profits, because they're stealing from working people and giving to rich people. And that, to me, is something we should really be upset about.
Absolutely. We got workers all across the nation fighting for better wages when the CEOs are making just millions of dollars. You have the companies bragging about record profits all across the nation, and yet folks are not getting a livable wage. And then you also have prices. I mean, the pandemic absolutely put a spotlight on this, especially with our meat. So meats cost the most they ever have for consumers. Workers were working in dangerous situations for low wages. Farmers are getting squeezed. And so I'm trying to reach out to farmers, to consumers, to workers, and say, hey, we need to get together because we're getting screwed here.
Now, you know, when we were in Sioux City and we met up with you there on our Working Class Heroes tour, you talked about, you know, a lot of stuff that, you know, I hadn't even really thought about. The fact that Iowa, I thought Iowa was part of the breadbasket of America that fed everyone. And you said that the majority of the crops that, and maybe I got this wrong, but like the corn crops don't actually go to feeding people.
No, 90% of the food Iowans eat it's imported, and most of it comes from California. And so there's a lot of the right wing loves to bash California when it comes to agriculture and stuff, but you know, you don't crap on where you eat. And so but to me, that's also a huge opportunity where what we can do in Iowa is really create regional food systems. And that's something I'm really trying to push and work with. I was blessed enough to go to Farm Aid a few weeks ago. And they had farm tours, they had a conference, they had a couple social events, and then they actually had the concert, which was phenomenal. But coming out of that, just I was there with legislators in other Midwestern states, and just talking about like the need to decentralize some of our food systems so we're not so vulnerable, and because food security is national security. And yep. So if the supply chain, like we saw during the pandemic, gets in a vulnerable situation, we could be in huge trouble. I mean, we saw what happened with the baby formula. That could happen very easily in milk with how concentrated we are. And so I to me, everything starts with antitrust. It's not the final answer, but it's the first step. And I'll say this about President Biden. He's the first president in my lifetime that he has addressed competition and done something about it in our economy, and with that executive order in his first summer in office. And then you have FTC, the chair, Lena Khan, doing a great job. You have Jonathan Kander at the antitrust division of the DOJ. They're pushing the envelope, and I love seeing it. I wish there was more. I wish the USDA could do more as well. But we're a step in the right direction, but there still needs a lot more work to do.
No, and this is important, and this is tangible stuff that could make people's lives better. But our mainstream corporate controlled media is never going to talk about, you know, our food right. supply in a way that makes any rational sense. Like Pennsylvania, either the first or the second largest industry is agriculture. You wouldn't think of that about Pennsylvania, but you drive through the center of the state, it's all farmland, you know, and you go through, you know, the Midwest. We should be producing all of our own food. We shouldn't be importing. At least I don't think so. And there have got to be better policies to get us to that point.
Not only are we importing, I mean, we're importing massive amounts of meat. And just think of how much meat we can produce ourselves. And so some of the trade laws are just trade agreements are just weird and bizarre. And I think we need to reestablish what we can do ourselves and what we need to do in order for some of this trade. But one of the other parts of it that I don't think gets discussed enough, and you mentioned corporate media doesn't tend to do this at all. We talk about country of origin labeling. Right now, a cow down in Brazil can be born down there, raised down there, harvested, brought up here in package and just repackaged. And because it's repackaged in the US, it can legally have made in the USA or some sort of USA stamp on it. And it's defrauding consumers. It's hurting our farmers and ranchers here. I mean, it used to be the law of the land. And then it just in 2015, they didn't renew it. And so I think that's just absolutely just awful for our farmers and ranchers, and also awful for consumers. And it's time we start addressing some of this stuff.
Yeah, but here's the thing: you know, we're put into this red hat, blue hat fight, rural versus urban. You know, people who live in cities aren't supposed to care about the people who live on farms. And I keep saying, you know, we're all interconnected. If farmers are getting screwed over, that means, you know, consumers in urban areas are going to get screwed over. There's a natural, you know, kind of symbiotic relationship that should be there. But again, we're pitted against each other to where we're not allowed to talk about these things.
Well, and that's where if we have a regional food system and more focus on the regional food system, I think that's where we have our city rural communications and just cohesiveness is when we have that. And we have more appreciation for local foods and it makes us healthier. State legislators had this call about this new pill that's supposed to help with obesity. And I was like, yeah, that's great. But like, let's go on the other side of the problem where we have healthier food that we can that make it cheaper and easier. Like I played baseball in Europe this summer. I was shocked at how healthy and how cheap the food was over there. And they prioritize that. And instead for us, we're prioritizing a lot of other things that makes us unhealthy.
So how do we get to that? How do we get to a place where you know, act a little bit more like Europe and have healthier food?
Well, I think the first start is with the farm bill. You know, we there's a great farmer out of Indiana, Greg Gunthrop. He had a great thing at the Farm Aid, or he was honored at the Farm Aid, and he had a great speech where he said, you know, I'm sick and tired of the farm bill. What we need is a food bill. And I think he's exactly right. He has kind of bucked the trend of, he's one of the few independent hog producers left in the country. And he has a special kind of hog that he helps raise. And it goes all over the country. And he does decent for himself, but he found this nice little niche in it. But that's a problem, is like he's an outlier. We need him to be in the way he does things. We need that to be more common. And so to me, it's let's create that infrastructure. Let's start having government contracts saying, like, when it comes to with our food supply, that a percentage of it has to come from local food. Once you create these infrastructure, then the market's going to take off. Like, the want and the desires are there. People want to know where their food comes from, and they, if the cost wasn't an issue, they'd prefer local.
Sure.
And so let's start subsidizing that rather than subsidizing getting cheap food. And like, here's an example. 60% of the apple juice consumed in the U.S. comes from concentrate from China. And just think of the environmental impact of bringing all that into the U.S. and then shipping it all across the U.S. when almost every state, there's thousands of apple orchards all across the nation. We could be producing our own local apple juice, but that's the way it is because of
that's how corporate America wants it.
Exactly.
No, this is one of, you know, I go back to what I said earlier. You know, who's this generation, Teddy Roosevelt? How do we start breaking up these monopolies? Last question I've got for you, completely different topic, because I wanted to have a little time to talk about the insanity in the House. Any thoughts about what's going on in D.C. with the children in the House?
You know, it just goes to show how they don't give a crap about the Republicans when they're in office, how little they care about running the government. And you look at, I mean, it goes back to 2017 and when they passed they had the House, they had the Senate, and President Trump was in office. And when they had a chance to pass anything they wanted, what did they pass? The main thing they passed, they couldn't get a lot of stuff done, but the one thing they passed was a tax break for the huge corporations and the super wealthy that were permanent tax cuts, and the working class tax cuts were temporary. If there's nothing more than those two things, that they care about their rich donors, and they don't care about us, and they don't care about governing the government and making it a functional government. To me, that's it's clear as day.
Yeah. No, spot on. JD, as always, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great stuff as usual. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, our good friend JD Schulten. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have a good talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1983. That was the day that Lech Walesa was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his work founding the Solidarity Union of Poland. the son of a carpenter, Walesa worked as an electrician in a shipyard. He was fired from his job for working to organize a union. Solidarity grew to include 10 million Poles. In 1981, Walesa was arrested and detained for nearly a year. He did not attend the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony because he feared he would not be allowed back into Poland once he left the country. His wife, Danuta, accepted the prize on his behalf. The speech he sent to the ceremony served as an inspiration to Polish Solidarity members and workers around the world. He wrote, "Let my words convey to you the joy and the never-extinguished hope of the millions of my brothers, the millions of working people in factories and offices associated in the union whose very name expresses one of the noblest aspirations of humanity. Today, all of them, like myself, feel greatly honored by the prize. With deep sorrow, I think of those who paid with their lives for the loyalty to Solidarity, of those who are behind prison bars and who are victims of repression. I think of all of those with whom I have traveled the same road and with whom I have shared the trials and tribulations of our time. We are fighting for the right of the working people to association and for the dignity of human labor." Walesa and his fellow workers did not give up on the dream of Solidarity. They continued to organize against the communist government for the rights of workers. In 1990, Walesa was elected president of Poland. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Site, TheRickSmithShow.com. So Tracy sent me an email. And I can't read it verbatim, but because there's some colorful language, which I appreciate. I appreciate colorful language. I do. She's questioning my want of a Speaker Trump. Why in the, you know, blankety blank blank would you want Donald Trump as Speaker? Well, first and foremost, I said from the beginning, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. There aren't going to be enough Republicans who are going to step forward and say, yeah, that's our guy, because they're going to have to go back home and run for re-election having done that. And look, as Marjorie Greene said, as Marjorie Three Names pointed out, it will be a MAGA rally every day. It'll be a rally every day. It won't be governing. There'll be no agenda. It'll be propaganda every day. It'll be well, a giant S show. Even more than it is now. And look, it's only temporary. He doesn't want to do it full time. So it's only a temporary fix. And Republicans need, you know, actual leadership. And I don't know who that leader is going to be. Because understand what the speaker's leadership power is. And McCarthy was their big fundraiser. If you lose your big fundraiser and you don't have someone to replace it, you got problems electorally. And this is where the Republicans really are going to have some problems, because they just kicked their biggest fundraiser, you know, right, you know where. Now, who steps into that? Jim Jordan? Really? One of the most unlikable guys in Congress? Seriously? With the baggage he's got? With all of the stuff that... all of the stuff that will come up around his time at Ohio State and all of the sex scandal and all the, you know, all of that. Or Steve Scalise, the guy who said, and I don't even understand this, the guy who said he's David Duke without the baggage. I don't know what that means. Does that mean he's a racist white supremacist that people don't know yet he's a racist white supremacist? I don't even know what that means and why you would say it. Bizarre. But that seems to be where the Republican leadership could be chosen from. Now, there may be someone. I know there's some other people who are, you know, trying to, you know, do some back climbing. But I don't see any solution real soon. And for me, look, Tracy, you know, the reality is, you put Trump in there, you've got massive chaos. And the American people will see massive chaos. Maybe it takes that kind of a shock to the system. Maybe it takes the kind of, you know, just out and out insanity for people to finally wake up and go, this isn't normal. This isn't right. As Daniel Ziblatt, the professor of government at Harvard University, was quoted saying, if you want to know what it looks like when democracy is in trouble, this is what it looks like. It should set off alarm bells that something is not right. We should all...
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.